Lowe's knows that no matter your paint project, saving is at the top of your list. That's why when you shop today, you can buy one, get one free select Valspar and HGTV Home by Sherwin-Williams one coat coverage interior paints via rebate. Shop these deals in-store or online today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Selection varies by location while supplies last. Discount taken at time of purchase. See sales associate for details. Offer valid 8/21 through 9/3.
Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining me on this very special episode of Turning Tides. We're joined by Qasem Rashid.
He's a human rights lawyer, an author, political commentator, a regular contributor to numerous major news publications, and a U.S. Senate hopeful in the state of Illinois. First of all, Qasem, thank you so much for being on the show. How are you doing today?
Doing well, given that our country might be headed towards fascism. One quick correction, I'm not a U.S. Senate hopeful by any stretch right now.
A congressional hopeful then, perhaps, in the future.
Who knows what the future holds, yeah, but right now, no plans.
No plans right now, okay, sorry about that. I understand you were born in Rawalpindi, Pakistan, originally, but you moved to Illinois at an early age. And you attended college in Virginia before moving back to Illinois. So how was moving around and experiencing all these different cultures and societies, how did they impact your worldview today?
Well, I did my undergrad here in Illinois. I went to law school in Virginia. And I think the ability to travel and to see different parts of the country and the world has been a blessing. I mean, it's been fantastic to experience things from different people's perspectives, different cultures. When I say different cultures, I mean even within the United States. It's a very different culture in Virginia than in Illinois. And I consider it a blessing, and it's formed a lot of, you know, my ability to meet with and converse with diverse people from diverse perspectives and find common ground.
And it must have been very interesting, especially going to school in Richmond, the home of the former Confederacy. That must have been its own can of worms.
Yeah, definitely was an interesting experience. I you know, have a lot of fond memories of Richmond, have a lot of good friends, the city of some really good people, and we certainly miss it.
So in a great deal of your writings and your work, you discuss the plight of migrants and asylum seekers. Now, there's a lot of controversy, especially in the United States, about what should be done in situations in which people seek asylum here. How would you explain to people who think that migrants are or can be dangerous to U.S. citizens that allowing migrants and asylum seekers to come here is actually beneficial to them as well?
Well, I think there's a lot of misinformation around what qualifies for asylum. People have made up terms like economic asylum, which doesn't actually exist. There's a very specific fact pattern that needs to be fulfilled for asylum to be granted by an asylum judge or an immigration judge. And you know, there's a very low fraud rate simply because the process is so thorough and specific. The people who are fear-mongering about migrants, I think they should reflect on a couple of facts. There's a study after study. In fact, there was a study recently done by Northwestern University that looked at the last 150 years of crime rates and found that there has never been a situation where migrants, documented or undocumented, had a higher crime rate than U.S. citizens. So what that means is that if you have migrants, immigrants, or even undocumented immigrants living in your neighborhood, statistically speaking, it's safer than if it is just U.S. citizens. And I think the second point I would make to them is our immigration policy has never been based on justice. It's always been based on white supremacy. You had the Chinese Exclusion Act, you had the Asiatic Exclusion League, you had a complete ban on Asian immigration in 1924. And it wasn't lifted until 1965, and even then there were limitations, whereas prior to those restrictions on Asians and on people from African nations or from South American nations, you had basically open borders immigration from Europe. More than 50 million immigrated from after the Civil War up until the 1920s. Interestingly, no complaints about open borders at that point in time. This is when land belonging to indigenous Americans was stripped away by force to the Homestead Act, 270 million acres to be exact, land that was then cultivated by enslaved Africans prior to and then post the Civil War via Jim Crow. And so to fearmonger about immigrants now, simply looking for a better life while ignoring the history of white supremacy and fascism that defined our immigration policy is just contrary to reality. So I think our job is to better inform and to demand a more just immigration policy, because as you said, the facts demonstrate that immigrants being present increases wages, increases innovation. I think I read that nearly half of Fortune 500 companies in the country today were started by immigrants or their children. And so if you care about the economy, if you care about higher wages, if you care about stronger businesses, if you care about more secure and safer communities, you want immigrants, because that's what immigrants have always done for this country and will continue to do.
If I can quote Lin-Manuel Miranda, immigrants, they get the job done.
That's right. That's right.
So I identify as a leftist, and I think a lot of us who are leftists saw the 2024 election as upsetting, but not really surprising. In one of your most recent episodes of the Let's Address This podcast, you discussed the litany of ways in which the Democratic Party completely dropped the ball during this election. Now, one of their main failings was the rush to the center to attract moderates and supposed, quote-unquote, never-Trump Republicans. Why do you believe Democratic politicians refuse to embrace populist reform and progressivism when both are proving exceedingly popular with the masses and centrist ideas and policies do not benefit the majority of Americans?
I mean, I think you nailed it, right? I mean, they are refusing, and that's a question to ask them, why they are refusing. I've read a recent survey that showed that 19 million Democrats stayed home that voted in the last election, just stayed home this time. And so if that's not evidence that these, sprints to the center are not winning over our base, they're not attracting our base, then I don't know what else they need to see. I think they are not working in a realm of reality when they continue to just avoid the obvious in front of us. And I'm hopeful that a younger generation of voters, of young people, can recognize that we are suffering under a class warfare system of exploitation by billionaires. And until and unless we stand united across race and culture and anyone who's a non-billionaire, it's going to continue to get worse. And what we're seeing in California right now with these fires is an example of that, right? It's decades of horrific policy that exploited the climate, horrific policy that exploited water, horrific policy that exploited prison labor, modern day slavery. And this is kind of the culmination of that. And these atrocities that we're seeing right now, they're not random happenstance. They're not unpredictable. They're very much predictable. And it comes down to the lack of economic justice in how we're proceeding. And so hopefully we can see future candidates for higher office that are more reflective of what Americans actually want. But I think we can help facilitate that by just young people staying active and engaged and demanding what's theirs.
Yes, I agree with you 100%. And you make the point of quoting Sir James Baldwin, if I can call him a sir, and his fantastic quote about hope and how we need hope. And it's interesting that you mention the lack of pull to the left that Democratic politicians are employing when it's obviously incredibly popular. On the other side, Donald Trump and his cronies have really no problem going as far right as possible. At the same time, though, Donald Trump, I feel at least, has been able to form a sort of rift in the Republican Party between the working class and the elitists. Do you feel Donald Trump should be credited even a little bit for inspiring this rift in spite of being an elitist himself?
I mean, I hesitate to give Donald Trump credit for anything, given his stated intentions of being a dictator on day one. I think where I would see a shift in the way politics has functioned has been a combination of the rise of Gen Z, the maturation of millennials, both generations who've seen either their entire lives or their entire adulthood, you know, ravaged by the U.S. being in these foreign wars that were unnecessary. We've seen, you know, my generation, you know, the millennial generation was the first generation born into the trickle-down scamonomics of Reagan, who himself, you know, was an absolute racist and just a terrible human being. And I think our generation is the first one to see the impact of the class warfare. And so I don't necessarily attribute anything to Trump in this space. I think this is just the natural result of, you know, now you have 45 years now of trickle-down scamonomics, and people aren't dumb. People are smart enough to realize that their pocketbooks are getting smaller and the billionaire bank accounts are getting larger exponentially. You know, we have worse wealth and income inequality now than we did even prior to the Great Depression, and it's unsustainable. And so, you know, you wouldn't credit a fascist in the 1920s with people recognizing that they're suffering under class warfare. I'm not going to credit a fascist now. I think people are smart enough to recognize these injustices, and our responsibility now is to act upon them in a meaningful way to bring about policy changes and bring about a sense of economic justice and fairness so that we can have the basic livelihoods that we all deserve.
Branching off of that, you talked about the fires which are ravaging LA County right now, and they're horrifying. It speaks to a climate crisis, which until a big event like this happens is almost never in the conversation. So in your opinion, what are some ways we can reignite the push for climate justice and make it intersect with our fight for social justice as well?
Yeah, I mean, I've always said that economic, social, and climate justice are three parts of the same vision. You can't have economic justice without social justice. You can't have social justice without climate justice. You can't have climate justice without economic justice, or whatever combination you want to have, because they're so interrelated. If you want to talk about economic justice, but you're not going to talk about reparations or equal pay for women or equal pay for migrant workers, then that's not true economic justice. If you want to talk about social justice, but you're not going to acknowledge the impact of climate change on Black and brown communities, or the fact that Black Americans are, I think, like 48% more likely to live by toxic waste dump, and Latino communities like 35% more likely, or that Indigenous communities are being devastated by pipelines, that you're not serious about social justice or climate justice. So the conversation has to be all three. And then likewise, if you want to talk about climate justice, but you're not talking about transitioning people off of fossil fuel jobs into green energy jobs, then you're not serious about climate justice either. You can't just tell somebody that your livelihood is gone because I need to save the climate. You need to be able to transition them to another economically viable vocation so that they can still provide for their family. It's the height of cruelty just to tell somebody, you don't have a job anymore, tough luck. You need to ensure that people have economic security. Otherwise, it's not a sustainable way of advancing climate justice. And the reality is that the science, the data tells us that there's no conflict between these things. There's no compromise to be made here because it's unnecessary. You can have economic prosperity and social prosperity and climate prosperity. Indeed, the only way to ensure sustainability of all three is to ensure that you're protecting all three going forward. So that's always been my conversation in this space, that if we truly want to elevate economic, social, and climate justice, then we do it in unison, because that's how we ensure it's sustainable in the short term and in the long term.
That's a great answer. And yeah, I agree with you. They all compound one another. You can't have one without the other. And anyone who tries to seek just one and not the other two, like you were saying, is really sort of selling themselves and the people that they're trying to represent a false bill of goods. We're going to switch it up a little bit here. With the fall of the Bashar al-Assad regime in Syria, the citizens there have a chance for self-government for the first time in what is probably centuries. Do you see a way forward for the Syrian people which does not involve meshing the government with religious fundamentalism or without the involvement of multinational corporations and foreign governments?
Yeah, I mean, I think centuries is probably an overstatement, but certainly decades. Mm. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think what we find throughout the history of the Middle East is a tragedy of sorts, especially post-World War II with Western interventionism. The amount of interventionism by the U.S., by European powers, post-World War II has been astronomical, and it's impacted severely the ability of these nations to have self-determination. So what I'm hopeful is that the people of Syria have the autonomy and the self-determination to be able to elect who they want in a democratically elected process without, you know, Western governments influencing or, you know, propping up their puppet leader, as we see in so many circumstances. Whether that happens remains to be seen, but we've seen the impact of, you know, Western governments trying to overthrow Middle Eastern countries, whether it's Iraq, whether it's, Afghanistan, and, you know, certainly, Libya. I mean, there's the examples kind of go on and on. Mm-hmm. But again, I'm hopeful that the people of Syria will rise up on these tenets of justice, on these tenets of human rights for all their citizens, for all their residents. And I'm hopeful that Western governments will not interfere, will not, dictate to the people of Syria what their future is and ensure that the people of Syria have their own autonomy and self-determination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the only thing we can hope for the resolution for any of these conflicts. And one genocide, which is currently raging, is the one against the Palestinian people in the Levant region of the Middle East. It's strangely enough a highly debated topic, especially here in America. This is strange because the funding of Israel's terror campaign against the Palestinian population is extremely unpopular, with over 60% of Americans wishing the United States would end its support of Netanyahu's apartheid-style government. So what would you say to Americans who still support Israel's occupation of Palestine?
Well, I think part of it is an answer that Jimmy Carter gave when he was asked why he considers Israel an apartheid state and why don't Americans know. And Jimmy Carter said, I don't think Americans want to know. And I think that's part of the problem here, that there are enough Americans who certainly recognize this massive injustice that's happening. And I think there's enough Americans who don't actually realize the lengths of these injustices. I was in occupied Palestine now almost 3 years ago and spent about 3 weeks in the occupied West Bank. And, you know, on no less than five separate occasions, I, as a U.S. citizen, as an attorney, traveling with former Israeli soldiers, traveling with former U.S. soldiers, veterans, was stopped at gunpoint by the Israeli military, forced to show my papers, forced to get off a bus. I was, you know, strip searched. And this is me as a U.S. citizen. Imagine the injustice imposed upon ordinary Palestinians who don't have a fraction of the rights or privileges that I have. And so I think part of it is, you know, telling the story in a way that can reach people. And, you know, Lord knows that the people of Palestine have told their story over and over and over and over again. And it's one reason why Netanyahu is so bent on banning access to journalists to Gaza, why he has sanctioned Haaretz, the oldest Israeli newspaper, for being critical of him, why his regime has killed more than 150 journalists since this genocide began in October of 2023, more than any other country in the world. I mean, he's killed more journalists than any other nation in the world. And so, you know, our job here is to help Americans understand that if you truly are somebody committed to the constitutional principle of equal justice, then here's an opportunity for you to exemplify that. And in doing so, you actually advance your levels of patriotism and you advance your levels of national security and advance your levels of integrity. The conversations I've had with folks across the political spectrum, once they've had a chance to understand that this is not a religious war, this is not about hating Jewish people. On the contrary, if we truly want to protect Jews and Christians and Palestinians and Muslims, then we do that by upholding international human rights law, by upholding justice, and by making sure that the U.S. government is accountable to its own laws. Remember, the U.S. State Department has acknowledged in multiple reports that the Israeli military is committing war crimes, and Blinken and Biden have ignored them, shamelessly, they've ignored them. This is where we need to maintain justice and uphold accountability, because this current model is simply not sustainable.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And I think that it's completely reasonable to support the two-state solution. One of the wildest facts is that Hamas supports the two-state solution, while Israel apparently does not. I think that says a lot right there about the level of animosity that the Israeli government holds towards all of Palestine, which they've made abundantly clear. Which is strange, because there are such historic ties of friendship between Jewish and Muslim peoples that could be brought back to thousands of years ago. So how do we bring that back into the conversation, as opposed to this historic enmity between the two? And do you believe that the outpouring of support from Jewish peoples, I'm thinking of Orthodox Jews, for example, who are against the brutality exhibited by the IOF and IDF, do you think that this has already started to mend those bonds?
Well, I don't think there's historic enmity. And I think your earlier point was exactly right, that there's been a historic alliance. Mm-hmm. You know, remember when Umar, the second caliph of Islam, conquered Jerusalem, he ensured that Jews, Muslims, and Christians could all stay. When Jerusalem was lost to the Christian crusaders, the Jews and Muslims were both massacred and exiled. And then when General Salahuddin retook Jerusalem, not only were Christians allowed to stay, as provided they lived in peace, but Jewish people were allowed to re-enter Jerusalem for the first time. That reign lasted more than 400 years of Muslim control of Jerusalem, where Jews were able to live and worship freely without oppression, without discrimination. In Moorish Spain, for 700 years, Muslims, Jews, and Christians lived in harmony, and Jews were protected from Christian crusaders. They're protected by Muslims. So what we find is a history of unity, a history of alliance. I always point out that in the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he established the Constitution of Medina, which was a secular constitution. And among its 47 articles, Article 18 says, no Jewish person shall be wronged for being a Jewish person. It was explicitly clear that anti-Semitism has no place in modern or any kind of developed or civilized society. And I think that should be remembered once more. And it should also be recognized that this conflict that people want to try to call it as is actually a genocide, is not grounded in any kind of anti-Muslim or anti-Jewish animosity. It's grounded in a political ideology that is expansionist and colonial in control. And that's where we need to stand united. And as you pointed out earlier, it's no accident that more than 60% of Americans, 77% of Democrats, 63% of Americans want to stop arming Netanyahu, because Americans across the political spectrum, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, you know, Hindu, Sikh, believer, non-believer, all recognize this injustice for what it is. And I think it is in that unity that we need to build upon.
Hmm. Yeah. And it's important to understand that the ties between Jewish and Muslim peoples go beyond just like, oh, we lived geographically close to each other. There are so many Jewish and Muslim people who share direct linkage, like in ancestry and in genetics. These people are closely related. You want to talk about anti-Semitism? It's just as anti-Semitic to be despising of a Palestinian person simply because of their ethnicity. Because guess what? Palestinians are Semites too, technically.
Yeah, I mean, genetically speaking, that's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, we're going to go back to America for a minute here, talking about the 2024 election again. You mentioned the swing to the right of many millions of Latine voters, specifically men. You say this has less to do with racism and more to do with class priorities and promises of economic betterment made by the Trump campaign. Well, I agree, it's certainly true that Latines have a history of flipping allegiances politically based on political promises. I think it's important to keep in mind the historic role race has played in all Latin American societies. I believe this generational trauma, which is linked to racism, going all the way back to the first European colonizers arriving in America, played a much larger role in the Latine voter, especially Latine men, abandoning the Democratic Party this election. In your opinion, do you believe there's any concrete reason why men rather than women are more easily swayed by racist politicians like Donald Trump?
Well, I want to go back to another point. I don't necessarily think it's entirely accurate to say that Latinos abandoned the Democratic Party. One demographic, Cubans, voted majority for Trump, but every other Latino demographic overwhelmingly voted for Harris.
Mm, and, okay. That, yeah.
You know, and I think that nuance is important because it's accurate, and also I want to make sure we're not unnecessarily being critical of an already minority marginalized community. I think where we need to kind of focus our attention is on, why is there a white lash in the post-Obama era? You know, I always make the point that in 2006, when the Voting Rights Act was renewed, it was passed near unanimously in the House, near unanimously, I think unanimously in the Senate, and then signed into law by a Republican president. And it further, enshrined and protected voting rights and voting access. And in the 7 years after that, you had Shelby versus Holder, which overturned significant portions of the Voting Rights Act. And one of the big reasons why there was that backlash, this white lash, is because after the Voting Rights Act was re-enshrined and expanded, you saw for the first time in U.S. history black voter turnout increase or be at a higher rate than white voter turnout.
Wow.
And now you have Republicans trying to, introduce more than 600 pieces of legislation nationwide to restrict voting access. You have more than 100,000 polling locations closed down, shut down across the country. That's more than half the polling locations in the country since Shelby versus Holder in 2013. And so, that's really where I think the focus needs to be on how do we stop this restriction of voting access. I don't think America is a red country. I don't think any state necessarily is a red state, with the exception of some. I think the vast majority are voter suppression states, and that's what we have to overcome if we want to protect our democracy.
Great answer. And yes, it's important to know the specifics of the Latine vote, because just saying, oh, Latinos voted more for Trump this time is a misnomer, like you were saying. I mean, Latinos encompass two separate continents worth of people. Three, actually, if you count the Hispanics living in Spain and Portugal. So it's important to bear that in mind. And thank you for adding that correction to my oversimplification there. So you've openly called Donald Trump a fascist. I agree with you. He certainly exhibits many fascistic traits. These include, but they're not limited to, an intense nationalism, the alienation of the perceived other, as well as the subtle and not so subtle use of political violence for his own gains. Besides this, Trump, alongside right-wing leaders across the globe, have adopted what Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek has called a quote-unquote soft fascism, in which powerful cabals use legality and the so-called rule of law to justify their pursuit of political power. How do you think we, as progressives and socialists, can approach moderate liberals and centrists with more success when trying to get them to stop excusing or ignoring this behavior and get them on the side of serious societal reform?
Well, I think one of the ways is to make sure we're telling our story, making sure that we're being unapologetic in getting our story out there. You know, part of the reason why I launched my Substack, Folks on Human Rights, is to be able to address these issues with facts and be able to provide receipts with facts. And it's been extraordinarily successful. I think we have nearly 100,000 subscribers so far, getting read nearly 2 million times per month. The second thing I think we need to do is activate our own base. 19 million Democrats stayed home that voted in the last election. Make sure we're engaging and activating our own base and getting them involved. Voter turnout is still abysmally low compared to other developed democracies. And then finally, I think we need to just get more young people, more representative people engaged in local politics. You know, forget the presidency for a minute, forget, you know, running for Senate or for Congress, but I'm talking local, hyper-local, the school boards, city councils, park district, library boards. This is where the meat and potatoes of democracy happens. And oftentimes we forget that if you want to fix that traffic light, that's not, you know, your congressperson's not going to do that. Your local city council person will. You want to get that pothole fixed up? Your local city council person is going to do that. You want to make sure your well water is clean? You have a water commissioner who's probably elected who's going to address that. And so I think doing those three things can go a long way towards protecting our democracy, even under a fascist president, and making sure that we set ourselves up on the path towards greater influence on the state and federal level in the coming years as well.
That's a great hopeful note to end on there. And so before we finish up for the day, I wanted to know, I know we only briefly talked about a litany of things here, but are there any issues you're currently deeply invested in which we did not get a chance to cover today?
Not that we covered it. I mean, like I said, economic, social, and climate justice is kind of the way I think about these things, about life in general. And you know, that's where a lot of my energy goes towards. How do we protect, you know, economic justice for folks? How do we protect social and climate justice for folks? And I think if we can solve those three things, we can solve 99% of the problems out there.
And where can people find you if people wanted to? I understand you have a Substack. I know I'm subscribed to it, but people can find that how?
Well, thank you for your support. Yeah, just my name, QasimRashid.com, QasimRashid.com. You can go on there, read my content, subscribe. Like I said, if you subscribe, you can subscribe for free or for $6 a month. Either way, my content is not paywalled. It will never be paywalled. I want my content to be accessible and available. And if people become a paying subscriber, I want it to be because they're inspired to invest in the work I'm doing, not because I feel like I'm trying to have some kind of a transactional relationship.
And I highly recommend anyone who's seriously interested in the modern political scene to subscribe to his Substack and to check him out on all the social media platforms you can. I know he's on Blue Sky. I know he's on several others. And finally, before we wrap up totally today, we haven't really had a chance. We've talked about history sort of extemporaneously, but not very seriously. But if you could have any historical figure over for dinner, who would it be and why?
I mean, if I were to go way, way back in time, I would pick the founder of Islam, Prophet Muhammad. But I think closer to home, you know, my dad arrived at the age of 26 in the United States back in 1976 with $30 in his pocket. And I would love to just sit down with him as a 26-year-old, unmarried, no kids, and just see the world through his eyes and understand what his thoughts and hopes and dreams and aspirations are. You know, my father, he's not well, he has Parkinson's, and so we're cherishing each day that we have with him. But that, I think that's probably what I would pick. I would probably pick some time with my dad at 26 years old in 1976.
Wow, that was really beautiful. Thank you, Kasim. So thank you so much again for being on the show. I really appreciate it, and thank you for bearing with me with the technical difficulties before. I had a great time talking with you. I'm sure our listeners enjoyed hearing your perspective. So thank you again.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's a privilege to be here.
Oh, thank you. And you can come back whenever you feel like. So thanks again to everyone who's listened to the show. And we'll see you on the next series where we cover the Puebloan peoples of the American Southwest. Once again, I'm your host, Joseph Pascone. Have a great day.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, MOVOPHOTO. Thank you again.